The man who never laughed. The sun is already high. It's July in the Cascade foothills of Oregon, 1926. And the light of the sky is colored like a hammered copper. The air smells like pine resin and locomotive smoke. And there's a man standing in the middle of a railroad bridge. He's not running, not crouched, not looking back over his shoulder. Simply standing, perfectly still, arms at his side, face as quiet as the wood beneath his shoes. The bridge is 35 feet above the Rock River. Behind him, a quarter mile of open track. In front of him, desolation, nothing, just the drop. And behind the drop, coming around a bend in the trees at 40 miles an hour, is an iron locomotive weighing 97,000 pounds. And it's not slowing down. Not for him, not for anything. The crew is watching from the bank. You see, the cameras are already rolling. And every person on that set, every grip, every gaffer, every person holding a clipboard is holding their breath. Because there is no net below the bridge. There's no mechanism to stop that train. There's no version of this where almost right is good enough. The man on the bridge had calculated this. Not estimated, not guessed, calculated. He knew the approach speed. He knew the braking distance. He knew exactly how many feet of margin he had between the moment the locomotive passed and the moment his body would need to be somewhere else. He had done the arithmetic in his head, you know, the way that other men balance a checkbook, casually and completely. The train rushes through. The bridge shakes. The wind off the locomotive hits him like a wall. And he goes over the back of the tender. He catches the ladder, rides it for exactly 4 seconds, and drops off. Standing up, still, unchanged. His expression has not moved, not once. Not from the first moment the engine appeared until this one. That face, that absolute, unshakable, stone-still face. It wasn't performance. It was never performance. What you were watching, what audiences in 1926 were watching, and what every person who has ever watched his film since cannot stop watching, is the face of a man who decided long before this moment that panic was a luxury that he simply couldn't afford. And tonight, we're going to understand exactly what that cost him. And exactly what it made him. My name is Mr. Hansen, and tonight we live inside the life of Buster Keaton. The child who couldn't brake. He was born on the 4th of October, 1895, a farmhouse in Piqua, Kansas. His mother, Myra, a clarinet player, barely survived the delivery. His father, Joe, a vaudeville man, a physical comedian, a man who made his living making strangers laugh, paced outside the door and prayed for the first time in years. And the baby survived. They named him Joseph Frank Keaton. He would not keep that name for long, though. The story goes, and there is no reason to doubt it, because the people who told it were there, that sometime before his second birthday, the boy tumbled down a long flight of stairs. Not a few steps, but a full flight. He rolled and bounced and landed at the bottom, and then he got up. No tears, no evidence that anything unusual had happened. a man from across the room, a friend of the family, a performer himself, passing through the vaudeville circuit, looked at the father. "That kid is a real buster," he said. The name stuck, Buster Keaton. He was not even 2 years old yet, and the falling had already started. By the time Buster was three, he was in the act. The three Keatons, Joel, Myra, and the boy, played the roughest stages on the roughest circuits across America. Traveling theaters and boarding houses, smoky halls where the audience threw bottles when they were bored and howled when they got what they came for. The vaudeville circuit of 1899 was not a polite industry. These were not concert halls. They were places where working people spent a few coins to forget the week that they'd just somehow survived. And they had no patience for anything that didn't earn their attention immediately. You had 30 seconds, maybe less. And you either had them or you didn't. And what they came for in the Keaton act was simply the boy. Joe had discovered something extraordinary. His son was made of different material than other children. When you picked Buster up and threw him, not tossed, but threw him, he didn't break. He landed, absorbed the impact in some way that shouldn't have been physically possible, and then simply got up. So Joe just incorporated it. He threw him into the flat backdrop. He threw him into the orchestra pit. He slid him across stages on his head. He flung him at the audience. Every night in two shows on Saturday, the audience thought it was some sort of trick. And the truth, it was not a trick. It was a three-year-old boy learning at the cellular level how to survive impacts. The authorities intervened more than once. Investigators would arrive to check on the child. They would question the boy and examine him for bruises, ask him if his father hurt him. Buster would just stare at them, calm and unreadable, fine. Because he was fine. Not in spite of what was happening to him, because of what it was making him. His body was learning to read the geometry of falling. His mind was developing a stillness that most adults spend their entire lives searching for. But something else was happening too. Something his father had not planned. The face. Joe Keaton had tried everything to get a reaction from his son on stage. Maybe a laugh, a grimace, a squeal of surprise. Anything that would signal to the audience that this kid was real and he had real feelings. Nothing worked. Buster would just take the impact, absorb it, and stand back up with that same expression. Blank and still. Not necessarily vacant, present, but utterly unreacting. Joe finally just understood. The audience wasn't laughing because Buster was funny. They were laughing because Buster refused to be bothered. The deadpan wasn't a gimmick. It was the act. The entire act. A three-year-old who would not visibly wound. And that is a thing people never understood about Buster Keaton. The face that never broke wasn't a lie. It was the most honest thing about him. Mastering the fall. Most performers learn their craft from the outside in. They study what works. They imitate what they've seen. They practice until the technique becomes instinct. Buster Keaton learned his craft the way a surgeon learns anatomy, from the inside, from the actual structure of the thing. By the time he was 12 years old, he'd fallen more times than most people fall in a lifetime. And he'd studied every one. He knew that the key to surviving a fall was not tensing against it. It was actually the opposite. You surrendered to the momentum. You found the angle of least resistance and just moved with it. And in doing that, you made the landing look impossible because before anyone else it would have been. He knew how to fall backward and protect his skull by pulling his chin to his chest. He knew how to fall sideways and redirect the force through his hips and shoulder in a single rolling motion. He knew how to take a running start, leave his feet completely, and land flat on his back without a single vertebrae absorbing the full weight. Now, he was not immune to pain. He was just immune to showing it. But there was something else developing in those years on the circuit. Something much harder to measure. A spatial intelligence. He could walk into any stage in any CD in any theater, and within minutes understand its dimensions in his body. Not by measuring, but by reading. He could feel how far the wings extended from the center line. He knew where a trapdoor sat by the way the floorboard sounded underfoot. He could stand at the back of a stage and know exactly how many running steps he had before the edge, without even counting them. And he could look at any physical environment and immediately see the possibilities that other people just couldn't see. No theoretical possibilities, but executable ones. What angle of approach would make a fall look worse than it actually was? Which piece of scenery struck at the right moment would send him exactly in the direction that he needed? Where to place the camera so that the impossible looked inevitable? He was designing his own stunts before anyone called him a stuntman. Not because he was reckless, but because he understood risk the way an engineer understands load-bearing walls. The danger wasn't in the act. The danger was in improvising without calculation. Prepare for every variable. Account for every failure point. Build the margins into the design and then execute them. There is a story from around 1908. Buster was then 13 years old. The act was playing in a theater in the South, a rough, rough house, a crowd that had already decided it wasn't going to be impressed. Joe threw him into a prop trunk. The trunk slid across the stage and hit the back wall hard enough to crack the wood. The trunk never fell over. Buster climbed out of it, looked at the audience, and he said nothing and walked back to his starting position. The silence that followed lasted about 3 full seconds. And then the place came apart. Not because the stunt was good, because the boy had taken it and he had taken all of it and given nothing back. No wincing, no satisfaction, no acknowledgement that anything had happened at all. And that quality, that complete, total, apparently effortless containment, well, that's not something you can learn from watching other people. It can only be built repetition by repetition, night by night, pain through pain, and town by town. By the time the Keaton family act was one of the most recognized on the circuit, Buster had become something of the vaudeville world and never quite produced before. A performer who made the impossible look inevitable. And he hadn't learned it from anyone. He had learned it from the floor. The camera doesn't lie. He was 21 years old when Roscoe Arbuckle handed him a camera. Not offered, handed it. The way you hand someone something when you want them to just understand. Roscoe Arbuckle. Fatty to everyone who loved him, and people loved him everywhere. He was the biggest comedy star in America in 1917. He even ran his own studio. He made his own films. He was looking for someone to work with. And the moment he met Buster Keaton, he knew he'd found him. They had multiple friends. Someone had made an introduction. Buster walked into the Comic Film Corporation on East 48th Street in Manhattan on a Tuesday morning in early spring. Arbuckle showed him around. He showed him the lights and the sets, the cameras. And then he put a camera in Buster's hands and said, "Take it apart, son. See how it works." most performers would have treated the camera as a tool for capturing them, a passive machine, something pointed at you. Buster took it apart in under an hour, and what he found inside changed everything. Because suddenly he understood something that most people in film, and actors, directors, cameramen, they had not yet articulated. The camera was not neutral. It did have a point of view. It had a certain geometry. What it captured depended entirely on where you placed it and how it moved and what you chose to put in front of it. And if you understood those things, if you truly understood them, not just used them, but designed with them, you could make an audience believe anything. You could put someone in genuine danger and make it look theatrical. Or you could put someone in a controlled situation and make it look like death. The difference was only craft. He appeared in his first film that same year, The Butcher Boy. He walks into a general store. He tries to buy a pail of molasses. Everything that can go wrong does go wrong. It is 5 minutes of comic violence and barely organized. And even there, even in his first film, you can see it. The stillness. The complete refusal to signal to the audience what they should be feeling. Most comedy of that era telegraphed. The comedian would look at the camera. He would register surprise. He would perform his distress for the audience. Buster didn't do that. He never did. He simply let the events around him happen. And because he refused to tell the audience how to feel, that changed everything. They felt everything. He spent the next 2 years inside Arbuckle's films like a student inside a university, watching, studying, understanding how a story is built in cuts, not in continuous action. How a frame can be used as a cage or an escape. How the camera's position tells the audience what to care about before a single word is ever spoken. He also learned something more fundamental. That the camera rewarded stillness in a way. In a way that live audiences never quite had. You see, in vaudeville, a performer needed to project. The back rows were real. The seats were far away. The camera had no back rows. It was 6 feet from your face. And at 6 feet, a shift in the eyes said everything that gesticulation would have ruined. The deadpan that had confused some vaudeville audiences, the face that refused to act, became, on film, the most magnetic quality in the room. The camera just leaned in. Because the face, that face, held something back. And the audience leaned in because they wanted to know what it was. By 1920, he had his own studio and his own films, his own vision, per se. And he was only 24 years old. Defying the impossible. The greatest stunt in history of cinema was shot in a controlled environment. But it was not carefully managed. It was not protected by technology that didn't exist yet. It happened on a Tuesday afternoon in Cottage Grove, Oregon in 1926. And the man at the center of it was standing completely still. The scene was from The General. The story of a Confederate engineer named Johnny Gray, whose locomotive is stolen by Union spies during the Civil War. Buster not only starred in the film, he directed it, he produced it, he designed every single sequence. He understood the physics of every single shot. And the shot they were building towards was this. A full-size locomotive crossing a burning railroad trestle bridge over the Roe River. A real locomotive. A real bridge. Real fire, real water, 35 feet below. He had surveyed the structure 2 weeks earlier. He had timed the burn rate of the wood, measured the bridge's weight-bearing capacity at various points along the span and calculated exactly when the supports would give. He knew how long the structure would hold under the engine's weight. He knew the approach speed required. He had calculated it all. What he could not fully calculate was what it looked like from the bank. Because when the locomotive reached the midpoint of the bridge, the burning structure gave way in sections, and the train went down into the river in a cascade of fire and iron and steam that the cameras could barely contain in a single frame. The sound was reported by residents a mile away. The crash cost $42,000. That's in 1926 dollars, a number so large that it nearly bankrupted the entire production. It remains to this day the single most expensive shot in history of silence film. He did it once, one take, because there was no second locomotive. There was no second bridge. There was no second anything. But that shot, that single, irrepeatable moment of controlled catastrophe is still playing somewhere on a screen right now. Because that's what happens when a man who understands risk better than fear designs something that can only be done once. You get something that lasts forever. Audiences in 1926 didn't see it that way. The General opened to moderate reviews and modest ticket sales. Critics appreciated the scope but found the comedy is thin. The studio considered it a disappointment. The film that is now considered one of the 10 greatest ever made lost money in its initial release. Buster said almost nothing about it publicly. He simply moved to the next project like a professional because he already understood something that critics hadn't caught up to yet. You don't build for the opening weekend. You build for what the thing becomes when time gets its hands on it. And then there was the house. Steamboat Bill Jr., 1928. A 2-ton building facade. Real wood, real weight. One open window in the upper story. The window frame measured 3 feet wide and 6 feet tall. The crew placed the wall carefully, measuring its fall angle, and drove a spike into the ground at the exact spot where the open window would land. That spike marked where Buster would stand. If he was off, even slightly, the wall would take him. There was no give, no net, no alternative. The director of the film, Charles Reisner, reportedly did not know about the gag until the day of the shoot. When he found out, he absolutely refused to watch. He turned away from the camera and stared at the ground. They rolled. The facade falls. He stands. The window passes around him within inches to spare on both sides. And he's alive. And then he looks back up. Still. As though the world collapsing toward him has nothing more interesting than a change in the weather. The crew was shaking. Buster walked back to the camera and asked to see the angle. Just the angle. To make sure it read right. This is the thing about him. The danger was never the point. The precision was the point. He wasn't chasing fear. He was defeating it through preparation. Every impossible stunt was just math that he'd already done. And what the audiences saw was that they still see. It's not recklessness. It is the most complete form of confidence that exists. The confidence of a man who has done the work. The world watches. Between 1920 and 1928, Buster Keaton had made 19 films. 19 complete, independent, fully realized works of visual storytelling. One every 5 months for 8 years. Each one different. Each one pushing the language of cinema into territory it had not occupied before. 1 week. The Playhouse. Cops. Our Hospitality. Sherlock Jr. The Navigator. Seven Chances, Go West, Battling Butler, The General, College, Steamboat Bill Jr. Some were hits, some were not. The General, now ranked by film scholars among the greatest films ever made, barely covered its production cost when it was released. Audiences in 1926 did not know what to do with a Civil War comedy where the hero fought for the Confederacy and the humor came from the mechanical precision rather than mugging. The critics were respectful but just confused. The studio was quietly concerned. Buster just kept working. Because he was not making films for the moment, he was making them for permanence. He knew the difference. He had always known it. Between what gets a reaction now and what lasts, the ones that last are just built differently. They're built from the inside out. From the logic of the world, not the appetite of the audience. He trusted the audience would find him. Even when they hadn't yet, what he was doing in those years, the technical invention, the narrative structure, the physical performance fused seamlessly with filmmaking itself, was unprecedented. Sherlock Jr. in 1924 contains a dream sequence in which the main character walked into a movie screen and becomes part of the film being projected. The cuts change the environment around him mid-step. He adjusts, stumbles, recovers, adapts, all in real time. While the world shifts from a garden to a street to a clifftop to a snowfield without warning, it is a practical effect. No double, no composite. Buster Keaton walking through a film within a film in 1924. Without computer assistance, without a safety net, without anyone telling him it couldn't be done. Because he was the one who designed it. He didn't push against the limits. He simply just didn't recognize them. And the sequence works. It still works a century later. Because he anchored each impossible environment change in his body's response. The environment changes, and he doesn't. He is the constant. The audience holds on to him because the world won't hold still. That is not an accident. That is architecture. Cops from 1922 is 3 minutes of a single man accidentally antagonizing an entire city's police force until hundreds of officers are chasing him through the streets. The comedy works because Buster's character never causes trouble intentionally. He just simply exists. The world decides to destroy him. And he survives, not through cleverness, not through fighting back, but through a kind of pure, unflappable persistence. He keeps moving. He does not panic. He is in the eye of the hurricane. And the audience laughs, genuinely, helplessly, because somewhere in everyone who has ever felt outnumbered by circumstances, the character is a mirror. You are this. You are the one person standing still while everything around you loses its mind. And somewhere in everyone who has ever watched a Buster Keaton film, there is a moment of recognition. Not the character. Of themselves, not just laughter, something older than laughter. The feeling of watching a human being press against the absolute edge of what a human can do and refuse to be impressed by it. That quality, that absolute refusal to perform his own competence is what made him unrepeatable. Anyone can learn to fall. Very few people can fall and look like falling is beneath comment. The silence breaks. In 1927, a film called The Jazz Slinger opened in New York. It had sound. Not just a musical score, voices. Real recorded voices coming from the screen. Al Johnson turned to the audience and said, "You ain't heard nothing yet, folks." And the world believed him. Almost overnight. Everything that had defined cinema for 30 years became a liability. The studios wanted talkies. The audience wanted talkies. And the performers who had built their entire vocabulary in the language of silent film found themselves holding expertise in something that nobody was buying. Buster Keaton was 33 years old. He was at the peak of his physical ability. His mind was sharper than it had ever been. He had a decade of filmmaking behind him. And in 1928, he made the worst decision of his professional life. He signed with MGM. The money was significant. The resources were real. And the creative control was, well, gone. Completely. From the first day. MGM was an industrial machine, not a studio for artists, a factory for products. They gave Buster scripts that he hadn't written, directors that he hadn't chosen, rules about what was funny and how funny was supposed to be expressed and to what exact moment the audience should be expected to laugh. Now, he tried to adapt. He offered ideas. He proposed approaches. They were received politely and then ignored entirely. The films he made for MGM between 1928 and 1933, they're not bad films, but they're not Buster Keaton films. They are products that contain Buster Keaton. The difference between a cathedral and a hotel room is not the dimensions, because they both have walls, they both have ceilings. But only one of them was built to make you feel something more permanent. He drank. Not slowly, not socially. He drank the way a man drinks when the one thing he was built for has been ripped from his hands. His marriage to Natalie Talmage ended in 1932. Their son stayed with her. The house, the Italian villa he had built in Beverly Hills on 20 acres, the place that he called home, was gone. In 1933, following a collapse that was both physical and personal, he was even institutionalized briefly. He was 37 years old. He was not dead, but the thing that had made him who he was, the control, the precision, the mastery of every variable, had been dismantled by an industry that didn't understand it and people who just simply didn't care. The Great Stone Face, that's what they had called him during the golden years. Now the papers didn't call him much at all. He still worked. Small parts, bit appearances, the occasional short film that nobody distributed properly. He lived modestly. He just kept moving. Because stopping for Buster Keaton was not an available option. It never had been. He had learned that before he could read, you absorbed the impact. You get up, and you don't react. The rest of the story. He was sitting in a small theater in 1950 when he first understood that the world had not, in fact, moved on. That it had simply been waiting. Billy Wilder was filming Sunset Boulevard, a story about a forgotten silent film star, a woman named Norma Desmond who'd been on one of the biggest names in Hollywood, now living in a decaying mansion, still convinced the cameras were coming back. The film is about the wreckage of silence, about what happens to artists when the world they were built for disappears. Wilder needed faces for a specific scene. A group of silent film legends playing cards in Norma Desmond's mansion. Ghosts gathered around a table, still present, still sharp, somehow both real and legendary. He asked Buster Keaton. Buster sat down at the card table. He appeared in the scene for less than 1 minute. He said nothing. He needed to say nothing. Because the moment he appeared on screen, even in a walk-on, even in a film about other people, something happened in the room where the film was being watched. People did what they always did. They leaned forward. the same way they had leaned forward in 1920. The same way they had in Vaudeville Hall his father had thrown him across. The camera could not stop watching him. And people who had never seen his golden work, who had no idea who he was, they started asking, "Who is that?" And the answer was just beginning. In 1952, he married for the third time, Eleanor Norris, a dancer 23 years younger. She had been his dance coach on a studio project in 1940. She had also watched him carefully enough to understand exactly who this man was. They were married for the rest of his life. She brought stability, she brought order, she did not try to manage him. She simply made it possible for him to exist without drowning. And then he began to work again. Television in the early 1950s needed comedians who understood physical timing. Buster understood it better than anyone on earth, anyone alive. He appeared on Ed Sullivan, on variety programs. He made short films for television that demonstrated to anyone paying attention that the reflexes and the vision and the physical mastery were entirely intact. The fall was still perfect. The face was, well, still. And then, in 1962, Henry Langlois, the director of the Cinémathèque Française in Paris, organized a retrospective, a full presentation of Keaton's silent work to audience who had largely never even encountered it. Filmmakers attended, and critics attended, scholars attended. And what they found was not nostalgia. What they found was a body of work so sophisticated, so technically advanced, so cinematically aware, that it felt as though it had been not made in the 1920s, but sometime in the future. The visual grammar he had invented, the deadpan center against physical chaos, the camera positioned to make physics into comedy, the chase sequence that functioned as geometric proofs. It was all there, fully formed, decades before the rest of cinema caught up. He hadn't been working ahead of his time. He had been working in a different dimension of time entirely. One where the question was never what the audience wanted today, but what the work would be worth when the audience finally arrived. They had been looking for Buster Keaton, and they found him inside films they hadn't even known to look for. Chaplin, who had been considered Keaton's rival for decades, thought Keaton had never participated in the rivalry, spoke about him publicly for the first time with complete honesty. He said that Keaton had been the great filmmaker, not the great performer, the great filmmaker. The craft behind the performance, the intelligence behind the image. In 1965, Samuel Beckett, the Nobel Prize-winning playwright, the author of Waiting for Godot, wrote a short film specifically for Buster Keaton. The film was simply called Film. It had no dialogue. It had almost no story. It was an exploration of the idea of being seen, of what it means to exist while something is watching you. Beckett understood something about Keaton that the industry had never fully articulated, that his silence was not a limitation. It was a philosophy. The absence of expression was not emptiness. It was everything withheld. And everything withheld was feeling and emotion and weight. Buster Keaton died on February 1st, 1966. He was 70 years old. Lung cancer from the cigarettes, from the decades of hard living, from the years that he had not been gentle. He died in his sleep at home in Woodland Hills, California. Eleanor was by his side. At his funeral, the eulogies were good but insufficient. Words have always been insufficient for people who communicated in different language entirely. What they said in aggregate was this: he was the greatest. He was ahead of his time. He deserved more than he ever received. All of that is true. But none of it is the whole story. Because the whole story is not what about was taken from him. It is about what could not be taken. They took his studio. They took his scripts. They took his marriage and his house and his best years. But they could not take the work. The work was already elsewhere, already permanent, already rolling in theaters in cities he had never visited, in languages he had never spoke, in decades he would not live to see. Every physical comedian working today carries something of Buster Keaton in the architecture of how they move. Jackie Chan has said it plainly. Gene Kelly studied him. Jerry Lewis called him the master. Wes Anderson built an entire films around the visual geometry Keaton invented. And it goes beyond comedy. Every filmmaker who has ever positioned a camera to make the environment work against a character owes something to those 19 films made in the decade when the entire medium was still figuring out what it was. Every director who has ever let a scene breathe without telegraphing it, its meaning. Every actor who has ever trusted the material enough to stop performing it. They're all in some way downstream of a man who was thrown across stages in the rural South before he was old enough to read. The frozen face, the straight line through chaos, the character who refuses to accept the world's disorder is reason to stop moving forward. Watch almost anything built from physical comedy in the last 100 years and you will find him somewhere inside it. Not as a reference, more important than that, as a foundation. What the great stone face was really telling us in every fall, every stunt, every impossible moment of standing still while the world collapsed around him, was something simple, something that takes a full life to learn. Fear is fast. Preparation is slower. But preparation is the thing that keeps you standing after everything meant to knock you down has passed. The train comes, the wall falls, the industry changes, and the world moves on. And if you've done the work, if you've truly done it quietly, completely, without needing anyone to see you do it, you don't run, you don't break. You stand exactly where you calculated you needed to stand, and you let it pass around you, and you walk away, still, unchanged, because you were never performing strength, you were simply being it. The difference between those two things is everything. Performing strength requires an audience. Being it doesn't. It exists whether anyone is watching or not. It existed on a Kansas farm in 1895. It existed on a railroad bridge in 1926. It existed in a screening room in Paris in 1962 when a room full of filmmakers encountered something that they couldn't fully explain. A man made of a different material than everyone else. A man who had been falling his entire life and never once let you see it cost him anything. That is the story of the man who never laughed and taught every generation after him what laughter is really made out of, what courage is really made out of, and what it looks like when a person decides, before they are old enough to name the decisions, that the world is not going to break them. And it means it every single day of their life. My name is Mr. Hansen, and now you know the rest of the story. Head over to MrHansenPodcast.com. Check us out, sign up, follow us, get the newsletter, find out all the cool stuff we're doing. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next Thursday.
this, Mr. Hanson. Pull your chair in tight. We're talking Buster Keaton by the glow of the night. Little boy in Kansas wind, chased by traveling tents. Tossed like a rag through the circus dust till the world made sense. He had a stone face, heart made of thunder. Walking through a crooked world built to pull him under. Every fall a prayer, every bruise a tune. That the stone face blues under a busted moon. Oh, yeah. Vaudeville curtains, cracked old boards. He learned to dance with danger, never say a word. House front falling, he don't even blink. You hold your breath in the dark, hold it closer than you think. He had a stone face, heart made of thunder. Walking through a crooked world built to pull him under. Every fall a prayer, every bruise a tune. That stone face blues under a busted moon. Lost them to the drink. Hollywood smiled, then pushed him off the brink. But he kept on walking through real and ruin. Cause a broken man's shadow still keep moving. He had a stone face, heart made of thunder. Walking through a crooked world built to pull him under. Every fall a prayer, every bruise a tune. That stone-faced blues under a busted moon.